This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by T. Rowe Price. At T. Rowe Price, we examine opportunities firsthand to help uncover the full story for our clients' investments. Put our strategic investing approach to work for you.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
Technological advances, industry disruption, and shifting economic imperatives are rapidly changing the workforce. On Tuesday, December 18th, The Washington Post took an in-depth look at trends and innovations that are creating the next generation of jobs and reshaping how, when, and where we work. How can policy adapt to ensure that gig workers and freelancers have access to benefits historically provided by a full-time employer? In this segment, two of the Senate's leading authorities on the American job market assess the situation and offer possible solutions to these emerging challenges. Let's listen.
Good morning. I'm Heather Long, an economics correspondent here at The Washington Post, and I'm honored to be joined today by Senator Todd Young of Indiana. I highly recommend you follow him on Instagram, where you will learn that he can still do 18 pull-ups, even in a suit. So, in one of his recent posts on Instagram. We will also be joined shortly by Senator Angus King of Maine. I also recommend checking out his Instagram. He recently posted a post of him raking leaves, where he says, "It's nice to take on a task where you can actually see tangible results." So a little bit of political commentary on Instagram. I'd like to remind our audience, you can tweet questions to our panelists using the hashtag PostLive, all one word, PostLive. We're going to start with some breaking news questions and then move into the meat of this conversation about jobs, 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 and the future of work, which I know you've been heavily involved with, Senator Young. So the big news of the day is obviously these two reports that have come out that are talking about Russia's disinformation campaign to disrupt our elections and our democratic process in this country. Are you confident that the outcome of the 2018 midterm election, that they were not impacted by Russia's disinformation campaign?
Well, I've read some open source articles this morning, actually immediately preceding this event, with the understanding that this might come up. And let me just say that I've been highly impressed with Mark Warner's work with Chairman Burr on this matter on the Intelligence Committee. At a time when there's much talk about tribalism and partisanship on issues of national security and electoral integrity, it's good to know that folks are coming together. With respect to my confidence, my preference would be to review the report, to consult with said colleagues and so forth before I opine further. But I do know that election integrity is something that, every member of the United States Senate is taking seriously, and I haven't sensed that people are prepared to score political points on this, which is really refreshing that we've still maintained that level of comity and statesmanship on issues of really, this comes down to national security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think when you read, there's the two reports. I know we're all still making our way through them, most of us. Yeah. But what comes across is this warning that it's still ongoing, that it wasn't just a once and done in 2016. In your state, a lot of battleground elections to come. What do you need to do?
I guess my message would be that we're going to have to remain vigilant. As someone who is an intelligence officer in the Marine Corps, I know that the history of battle is one of measures meeting countermeasures. And so to the extent we're able to come up with some mechanism, some prophylactic mechanism to make sure that no one infiltrates our elections or influences our electorate in an improper fashion, there will be some way invariably around that, and we're going to have to just stay eternally vigilant to make sure that our elections are secure. So I think this is the new normal. It's not just Russia. There will be other countries seek to do this. There are other countries that in the past have tried to insinuate themselves into our electoral process. And even in the United States, if you look into past decades, retrospectively, we involved ourselves in others' elections. So it is important that... that said, the United States, a Republican democracy, does all we can to make sure that people have faith that when they cast the lever or they, you know, touch the screen, that their vote not only counts, but it counts for the candidate that they intended to vote for. And also, they shouldn't go into the voting booth under a misimpression about particular candidates' positions or so forth. And it's becoming more complicated in this digitized world where we rely on so many different, multifarious news sources. And oftentimes there are unnamed sources for particular articles. And so I think even the media is struggling to adapt to this new normal so that the people can really rely on the news they receive.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You obviously use Instagram, as we were joking about earlier, for and I think that's one of the things that surprised a lot of people in this report, that everyone thought that a lot of this disinformation was happening on Facebook and on Twitter, and instead there were even more posts happening on Instagram by some of these foreign entities. Do we need to regulate social media more?
Perhaps. I mean, it's a debate we ought to have. I think so many of us are trying to figure out exactly what that would look like. Mm-hmm. The business model of many of these social media platforms is kind of a volume-based business model that relies on advertisement and so forth, and the business model of many of the largest and most subscribed to platforms could be ruined to the detriment of all who benefit from these platforms if we're not very careful in working with them to accommodate the needs of users who get real value out of social media on one hand, but also make sure that we're not undermining our entire democracy in the process. I don't sit here today, as I'm prepared to talk about the gig economy and independent workforce, pretending to have all the answers. But I am a member of the Commerce Committee, and we've started to hold some hearings with respect to this issue. And I know that Silicon Valley is increasingly trying to get out in front of this, taking it seriously, knowing that if they don't come with solutions in a box for members of Congress with respect to a new regulatory atmosphere, we will have to come up with some solutions independent of their thoughtful recommendations. And we don't want to have collateral damage, but we may have to sort of find our way moving forward to protect our democracy. So that's the best answer I can give you right now.
Mm-hmm.
Here again, I would just indicate that Republicans and Democrats alike, to my mind, see this issue the same way, which is really helpful when it comes to getting things done. We're just relying on sort of the subject matter experts from the intelligence community to those who have designed these platforms members of the media to help us figure out the proper balance.
I'm glad you said that about the bipartisan agreement that this is a real problem. I have to say some of my colleagues at the Post were calling a bunch of Republicans yesterday, and only Senator Richard Burr, the Republican from North Carolina who chairs the Intelligence Committee that issued these reports, he was the only Republican that spoke out and issued a statement yesterday. And I think people were a little surprised not to see more bipartisan concern and maybe condemnation of what's been revealed by these reports and by the intelligence community. Why don't you think more Republicans are speaking out?
Well, my understanding is these reports referenced Russia, and that's where the focus of these reports was. You can correct me if that's incorrect, not having read them, but news reports indicated that they invoked Russia. This administration has been incredibly vigilant with respect to Russia, from sanctions to heavy weaponry in Ukraine to responding in kind in the cyber realm, to making sure that they check Russian expansionism in the Middle East. If Vladimir Putin thought that this administration was going to be friendly to Russia on various fronts, he's been disabused of that, and Congress has worked in a bipartisan way, I can say as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to also apply pressure to Russia. So with respect to public statements, when this report was released, I think it's common practice for a chairman and a ranking member to speak about a public report. And thereafter, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we have particular members of the Intel Committee who are read into all the Intelligence mm-hmm. Committee offering their own statements. But I'm not aware of any space that exists between your R members and your D members, or it might include an I member in there as well, as Senator King shows up.
It's good intro.
Wow. What timing. What timing. Yeah, thank you.
You just hear your name.
Nice to see you.
It's good to see you.
How are you? Thank
Welcome
you.
Welcome to the Washington Post.
Nice to see you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I think Senator Young is relieved you're here. We've been pounding him on
really
these
not.
New reports.
I'm eager to discuss this at greater length after having read that one article about it. And now I'm just teasing, of course. But I know the spirit of my response to these reports coming out is consistent. I'd be surprised if we're not consistent with your position, which is...
Is this on the reports of the
That's
last
right.
couple of days?
What's your biggest...
I thought we were on the gig economy.
Yeah, I did too.
We're
on the gig economy for Russians.
Well, we both got gigged on this. Let's hope that... Putin is a member of the independent workforce, and that's right. Yeah.
All right, Senator King, two quick questions for you. You've read these reports. You're on the Intelligence Committee. What are you going to do about this disinformation?
That was the question I was afraid you were going to ask. First, the reports are very powerful and I think underline what we've been saying for a year and a half.
So you've read them?
I've read about two-thirds.
Welcome.
I was flying down yesterday on the plane and
Fantastic.
Had to hold my phone sideways. Yeah. So I could read it. But the data is pretty overwhelming. I think the big number was 130 million Americans at least were affected by this. It's a very difficult question to know what to do because we're a free society.
Right.
We have the First Amendment. And the Russians are improving their tradecraft in the sense that in 2016 they did a lot of organic, they created their own material, their own websites, their own rumors and all of that. Now what they're doing, it appears, is more amplifying things that are already out there. Somebody in America publishes an outrageous conspiracy theory and they amplify it and increase it and use the bots to make it trend. What you do about that is very difficult. It's not like we can just, cut off people on the internet who are saying outrageous things. We've already learned that that's very difficult. So this is a long way of saying, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it requires some real serious thought. What they're doing is a kind of geopolitical jujitsu. Remember when we learned jujitsu was using your own strength against you? And that's what they're doing. Yeah. If we weren't an open society, we could shut all this stuff down and just, turn it off. But we can't. And so they're using the strength of our open society, First Amendment, free speech, to undermine the very values of the country. It's a very difficult problem to figure out where that line is.
So I actually do want to build on the mention of the First Amendment. So if we were to apply the same sort of libel laws to one of your popular social media platforms that, say, the Washington Post has to abide by, the business model of these social media platforms would absolutely fall apart because they cannot hire enough people to check every post and validate every claim. And so there are different types of platforms, yet increasingly so many Americans rely on these platforms for their news. That's why this is...
And Facebook doesn't know whether it's a newspaper or just the back fence that anybody can put a poster on.
I mean, right.
That's the dilemma.
I'm glad you brought up Facebook. One of the things in the report that jumped out at me was this line, regrettably, it appears that the platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, may have misrepresented or evaded in some of their statements to Congress, which was a pretty bold thing to say in a report. Are these companies doing enough to cooperate with the Intelligence Committee and provide you what's needed?
I think it's fair to say they certainly weren't at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it was protecting their business model, but also part of it was they were naive. I don't think they really realized the extent of what was going on. They've gradually, I think, become more aggressive, and I think recently, as a matter of fact, there's a line in the report that says Facebook is doing a much better job. And I think they are trying to be on top of it. But again, it's a very difficult, if a post, it's not the ads so much that are the problem. It's the news feed that comes in that looks like, you know, somebody's writing, have you heard that this and this happened? And then it gets repeated and repeated. And I can tell you as a politician, this stuff is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because if somebody does a negative ad on TV, you can put your own ad on TV to respond to it. They're lying about my record. If it's something on social media, it just ricochets around. You never get a chance to really confront it. And it's you can never, you know, put it to rest. It just keeps multiplying. So I think the companies are doing a better job. I think Facebook is taking it very seriously, to be honest. Google has been a little more reluctant because YouTube was a big part of what
right.
this report talks about. And I think Google has been slower. And as you recall, we had a major hearing at the Intelligence
right.
Committee. They didn't even come,
yep.
and they should have.
Well, we will switch gears pretty dramatically to the job sector now. Senator Young, you know, when we talk about innovation in this country, I think it's a real shame that people often don't think of the Midwest. They don't think of your state as one of the first parts of where we're being innovative in America.
I do, too.
So how do you make sure the industrial Midwest is part of the technology revolution? How do we do that?
We've got the right senator up here to speak to that, because Indiana happens to be the most manufacturing-intensive state in the country.
Right.
And there is incredible innovation, arguably more innovation occurring in the manufacturing sector than there is the services realm when you look at the productivity improvements and so forth. And that has been that's been incredibly disruptive, but also promising in terms of the growth opportunity. So your question was about how we should think about this.
Well, how do you transition?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
is it just enough to let the companies evolve into
yeah.
the future, or do you need something else?
Something. I think this will be a whole of society effort, right? It's going to require government at different levels, federal, state, and local, coming up with new models. Hopefully piloting a lot of different new models, whether it's related to benefits or workforce training programs. We can partner with not-for-profits and
right.
also the private sector. And together, we're going to have to sort of feel our way through this. This is this transition into a new normal where workers prepare for jobs in K through 12, maybe pursue some post-secondary education, obtain a certificate, obtain an associate's degree, maybe go on and get a bachelor's degree thereafter. And then the expectation will be they're going to undergo a series of retraining programs as well and move from one job to multiple jobs throughout their career. This is really we're already in kind of the middle of this transition, but it's going to take a number of years. It's akin to the movement from an ag economy into a manufacturing economy, and it's not something that was adapted to in 10 years. It really took a couple of generations to get everything sort of set.
Yeah, and in that transition, there's also probably going to be a lot more people who aren't working directly for one company.
That's
maybe
right.
They're independent contractors or consultants or something along these lines. And you've really focused on that by introducing a bill with Senator Warner, the Portable Benefits for Independent Workers Pilot Program. Can you say a little bit about what that is and why is it just a pilot program? Why aren't we ready to actually introduce a full bill?
Let me just start with the easy part, the pilot program. I think we in government for, frankly, generations have introduced too many big, large, ambitious, expensive programs. And then after a rigorous evaluation, when that happens, it usually doesn't even happen, we find out that we wasted a lot of money. So instead, we should take a page out of business's book and we should pilot a lot of different models, rigorously evaluate, and then scale those things that are determined to actually benefit American citizens in a meaningful way. And so that's the pilot program. This particular model is one in which the federal government takes some modest resources, $20 million, and offers grants to existing businesses to scale portable benefit models that are working into other geographies and then rigorously evaluate those scaling exercises. We can do the same things with not-for-profits or state and local governments. To the extent that a portable benefits model does not exist within a particular space, we can use this money to design, implement, and then evaluate said programs. So I think we need to do this throughout government, frankly, not just with respect to portable benefits, mm-hmm. but also workforce retraining,
right.
as I mentioned.
Okay. Senator King, you've been tweeting about one of the big issues in America as we move forward is that a number of people in this country still don't have good internet access, including
right.
in your state.
It's a huge issue.
How close are we to getting there?
Well, first I want to touch on something that Todd mentioned, and that is the transition. In 1850, 95% of Americans worked in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed, obviously. Now it's like 3%, and it changed. But it changed in 200 years. It took 175 years. It took a long, long time for that to happen. We're now seeing these transitions happen in years and sometimes in regions in a month where a whole industry will go away,
yeah.
and then what happens next? Broadband is the essential infrastructure of the 21st century. I mean, that's a pretty commonplace observation. The problem is in rural America, it's not there. And there's a rural broadband caucus in the Senate, started by myself and Shelley Capito of West Virginia, and you know the usual suspects that you can imagine, the northern tier states, some of the southern states, because broadband, it's exactly what happened with electricity in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
In the 30s, electricity first was available in dense urban areas because the houses were closer together and it made more sense to string the wires. The electric company said, we can't do this in these farms that are a mile apart. And so Roosevelt, they did rural electrification with co-ops and those kinds of things. That's exactly what's happening today. And of course, the technology is changing so fast. But the truth is, rural America will be, it'll be catastrophic if we can't get broadband in because they're not going to be able to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Turning it over, broadband in rural areas produces enormous opportunities. I have people in Maine where we have good broadband in many of our small towns that are working all over the country. I walked into a coffee shop and people were working in Boise and California and MIT. And so if you have that connectivity, suddenly you open up employment opportunities for people in rural areas that just weren't there before. So the first piece is good broadband. And in the Farm Bill, I think $380 million for broadband for precision agriculture for
right.
the farming community. A big deal. I'll tell you how,
so how
times
close
change.
Are
5 years ago, it was $25 million. This time, it's $380 million.
Yeah, so people are recognizing
the problem.
Yeah, the need.
So if I could just build on something that Angus said with respect to how the disruption in certain local or regional economies often occurs in fairly short order. This is occurring in little geographies around Maine, around Indiana, and people are indeed struggling to adapt. So we need to scale up as many things that are working as quickly as possible, and then really experiment with new models. To put some numbers on this, within roughly a decade, by 2030, it's estimated that throughout the world, now, this is a broad range here, between 3 and 14% of the global workforce are going to have to switch entire occupational categories. That's over a 10-year span, entire occupational categories. But that obscures the fact that if someone remains in a particular category, the nature of their job is going to change significantly as well. So a journalist, a public servant, you know, someone who's working at a call center, or a
our
medical
categories are liable to change every 6 years.
A medical professional. Well, I mean, they may stay in the same job category, but the nature of their work will significantly change. So they're going to need to have mechanisms for continuous retraining, which is really something we're going to have to focus on.
And is that you know, some states have started funding a community college like Rhode Island, where they'll give people free community college for 2 years to help do that retraining in those states, another industrial state that's trying to transition. Is that a model that you think works?
We have the largest community college system in the country in the state of Indiana. It's a unified system, and it does work. But
can people afford it? So I think that's what, when Rhode Island, the state government is actually funding for people to go and do that kind of training.
Let's see how that works. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that everyone needs to be able to play a meaningful role in this growing economy, where unemployment is now 3.8%, and workers in and employers in my state are struggling for workers. But most importantly, we need to make sure that when someone pursues a program of study, which is going to pay them more on the back end and help them pay back whatever loans they may have taken out in addition to the grants, that program of study is valuable. It allows them to land a job that pays well on the back end. And B, they're actually able to complete the program of study. The most tragic thing that I hear in my travels around the state is when someone pursues a program of study, incurs debt, and then has absolutely no certificate on the back end of it. They're no more employable.
Yeah. There's another aspect of this that I think is important from a labor and employment point of view. The biggest issue that I find in traveling Maine and talking to people around the country right now is lack of workers. They're having a very hard time finding qualified workers. Again, going back to the idea of rural broadband, work at home, this is a way of opening up a workforce that's available and could assist with other. Eventually, the lack of workers is going to be a real drag on our economy. I know in businesses, they just aren't expanding. They aren't growing because they can't find the people.
Do you turn around and ask them, have they increased wages? In those
I
sectors?
Always do.
Yeah, because
sometimes they say yes, sometimes no. And I bragged about Indiana being the most manufacturing intensive state in the country. 80% of manufacturers in this country right now indicate they are unable to meet customer demand or to expand their businesses on account of labor shortages.
One of my favorite signs was in front of a sandwich shop, you know, and it said, now hiring health benefits and 401k for a sandwich shop. Now, that's the market working.
Although wage growth, it's better than it has been, but it's still weak compared to, say, the 1990s, early 2000 boom. So that's an ongoing
conundrum. I think there's a lot of opportunity in rural areas. You don't have to build a big factory anymore, or you don't have to build a big office building. You can have your workers dispersed into the community, and it opens up an opportunity, A, for people in rural America, and also for companies that need people.
Right. On a scale of 1 to 10, we'll go for each of you. How worried are you about automation? Robots, all these headlines telling us robots are going to take my job, maybe your job one day. How worried are you about automation? Is this something we should fear?
Put me in the 5 category because I'm incredibly excited about the possibilities. You know, within 15 years, we could increase the rate of productivity by 40%, I hear, and this comes from McKinsey Global. Hopefully I'm citing the numbers correctly. So that's great. That means more wealth for our entire economy, more wealth for Americans to invest in infrastructure and other public goods like public health. But at the same time, it can lead to great disruptions within the labor force. So that's the other side of it. And we need to do our part working with not-for-profits and for-profit companies.
And the educational
thing out.
So people can transition.
Right.
I'm less worried about it even than five, because people have been saying automation is going to destroy jobs since the steam loom was invented in 1730. Seriously, I mean, all of these very alarmist kinds of things. There always seem to be new jobs that we didn't think about. You know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, nobody ever heard of web designers and all of those things. So I think there'll be additional jobs that will come out. But the key is, here's the problem. I had a case once in Maine where a shoe factory closed, and we lost 200 jobs. The same day, one of our tech companies hired 200 people to do computer work, and they were doing insurance claims in another state or something like that. So on paper, we lost no people. 200 lost, 200 gained. They weren't the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who lost those shoe jobs, that's all they had done.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to be able to pick up and go to Portland and suddenly sit down and start processing claims. That is the challenge of what I call stranded workers.
Right.
And we have to do a lot better job of providing immediate good retraining to bring people from one kind of, as you talked about, one career to another. My grandfather worked for the Southern Railway for 52 years.
Right.
Very few people do that anymore. You've got to change careers three or four times, let alone jobs.
Yeah.
As policymakers, we're flying a bit blind, I feel. We need to improve our gauges, as it were. We are told by the Department of Labor, and they're doing the best they can statistically, that in 2005, there were actually more members of the independent workforce, your gig workers, your contingent workers, and so forth.
I'm glad you brought that up.
So they had a larger percentage of workforce in 2005 that were fell within that independent workforce category than now. Intuitively, really seems off.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to have confidence moving forward as we develop policies in this area, I think we need to optimize our data collection, which is a boring issue but highly important for those who take facts seriously.
Yeah, I think you're right. We wrote about this. The latest Labor Department statistics are that 15, just over 15 million Americans are in the, quote, gig economy or independent contractor type work. And that's only 10% of the workforce. And like you, we were stunned. A lot of readers were stunned that wasn't much higher. It feels like it should be closer to 25%. How quickly do you think it'll grow? I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, it didn't grow from 2005 to the latest study in 2016.
I think it has grown, depending on how you measure it, right? The way the Department of Labor now asks the questions through their surveys is whether or not someone's primary occupation is within the independent workforce. But raise your hand if you've taken an Uber or a Lyft within the last month here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. Most of you have had some level of communication with your Uber or Lyft driver, and you discover that this is a side job for a number of them. So they're not even included in current numbers. So
that's right.
You scale that over all manner of different professions, and we're just missing a lot of people, so we've got to get better at that.
Yeah, because the Labor Department is measuring people's primary job, and so if Lyft or Uber is their side job, that's not their primary, and that's not being captured in those gig numbers.
Yeah.
One of the biggest risks to the workforce is if we have a downturn in the next couple of years, that a lot more workers would be dislocated. The stock market's certainly not been going in a direction many of us would like to see. What's your read?
Which, by the way, points out the primary, we're talking about benefits in the gig economy. What's number one? 401ks, which aren't doing all that well right now.
That's right. A lot of investors say they're nervous about a slowdown, maybe even the R word, recession, by 2020. What's your read when you look at the data or when you look at what you're seeing in the stock market and your own 401ks and pension plans?
Well, I don't want to talk the economy down, but if you look at historical numbers, I mean, we would be due for a downturn in the economy. We're actually past due.
Mm-hmm.
So this expansion has occurred over a longer period of time than most economists would have predicted. So we just need to prepare for the storm.
Yeah.
Especially while times are relatively good, though I know there's been a recent dip in the stock market. And that means coming up with new portable benefit models so that people can retire securely regardless of whether they're in the independent workforce, whether they're in the attached workforce, traditional workforce, or some combination thereof. The retraining models that I discussed, and I do agree. I want to embrace what Angus said with respect to investment in public goods like rural broadband. Really important. Really important.
Todd and I have been talking recently about the deficit. And one of the problems with the current deficit is, number one, it's enormous, and number two, we've used up our slack to deal with a recession or to deal with a crisis.
Right.
And we've cut taxes during a boom, we've cut taxes during a war, and we've created a situation where there's no. If you remember, the reaction to the 08 recession was a $1 trillion public fund to try to build things around the country to try to stimulate the economy. Query whether we can do that again today because we've dug ourselves into such a deep hole. That's just sort of a parenthetical that worries me, that we've used up our safety net, if you will,
heading into
dealing with whether it's recession or
whenever conflict. It comes.
And we've failed over, frankly, generations to take seriously the predictions of actuaries related to the aging workforce, the increase in health care costs, and to make sustainable the largest programs of government, which we all want to do.
We're the first generation in history to inherit from our parents and borrow from our kids.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, that's a whole nother conversation. we just want to close out. We are here at the Washington Post, and obviously it's very important to us what happened to our colleague Jamal Khashoggi at the hands of the Saudi government. You both voted in favor of resolutions recently to link the death of Jamal Khashoggi to the Saudi Crown Prince. You also both supported and you were very instrumental in making happen that resolution in the Senate to call for a withdrawal of U.S. support for the Saudis' war in Yemen. Saudi Arabia rebuked that Senate resolutions that you both supported. What's your response to the Saudis?
My response is they would be much better served to take responsibility and make amends and move on instead of continuing to deny the obvious. It just undermines anything else they want to do. On the other hand, I think the administration made a mistake by creating a kind of either-or. Either you absolve the prince or you maintain a relationship with Saudi Arabia. I think there's something in between there. You don't have to abrogate the whole relationship in order to call them to account for a really horrendous act. And I think it was unfortunate the way the administration treated this initially. The Congress, the vote we took on Yemen a couple of weeks ago was the first time in 45 years that a House of Congress has actually implemented the War Powers Act and exercised some control over the executive use of the military. That's a big deal. It may not pass the House, it may not be signed by the President, but just the fact that I think the Senate asserted itself and the Saudis felt they had to respond to it indicates that the message was received.
Senator Young, should the President condemn the Crown Prince over this? Kind of like what Senator King was saying?
My focus from the beginning has been to make sure that I give this administration and this President maximum possible leverage to bring the Saudis into a position of better behavior, to drive them to the negotiating table, and to ensure that they negotiate in good faith. And I don't think it was a coincidence that the day the United States Senate took this vote, the day that it passed, this resolution passed the United States Senate, was also the day a ceasefire was arrived at. in Sweden with respect to this conflict in Yemen. So we need to continue to provide this administration the leverage they need to apply pressure to the Saudis.
And
we do need to speak.
Do you think it makes a difference if the president does make a verbal condemnation similar to what Senator King
said? I think each of us needs to make a verbal condemnation of the Saudi behavior. I've said unambiguously, and I'm so happy that the Senate has spoken in a clear voice, indicating that the Crown Prince has been reckless, he's been impulsive, he's engaged in monstrous behavior, and I think that we will remain vigilant on this. In fact, the law requires it. The president signed into law, he's to be commended for it, he signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act. Right. As part of that act was a piece of legislation that I worked on with, in a bipartisan way on the Foreign Relations Committee, requiring this administration to certify the good behavior, as it were, of Saudi Arabia. They certified. I wasn't persuaded by the certification, the good behavior some weeks ago. They'll have another bite at the apple in coming weeks. Let's see where they stand.
That's great. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. We're out of time, but we appreciate you having both of you here at the Washington Post to talk about
And you're
jobs.
A lot better off that I'm here rather than Warner. You know that.
See you, buddy.
See you.
Yeah, that's great.
Hey, thanks again, Senator.
Yeah.
Thanks, Senator. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.